Hello, my name is Matthew Rafferty, host of American Studies on the New Book Network. I'm here today with John McMillan, author of Beatles vs. Stones, which first came out in 2013 and just recently in paperback on Simon & Schuster. Professor McMillan is an associate professor of history at Georgia State University. He's the author of 2001's Smoking Typewriters, the 60s Underground Press and the Rise of Alternative Media in America. And he's the co-editor of two volumes, The Radical Reader and The New Left Revisited. And he's also an editor of the journal The 60s, a journal of history, politics, and culture. I also want to say, personally, it's a particular pleasure to talk to John because we overlapped during our graduate studies at Columbia University, where Professor McMillan received his PhD. So first, I want to welcome you to the New Book Network.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
And before we delve into the Beatles versus Stones, I'd like the listeners to learn a little bit about you. Where are you from and how did you first become interested, particularly in the history of the 1960s?
Well, I was born and raised in Michigan, and my family moved around a lot, but mostly to different locations in Michigan. And then, growing up, I was in sort of a small town. And, there was no internet. There were no zines. It was kind of hard to sort of build a connection with what seemed like an alternative, any kind of subculture that was, present at the time. But I really glommed on to the 60s as sort of a layperson. So all through high school, I had a layperson's interest in the Black Panthers and Abby Hoffman and Charles Manson, even though that sounds a little bit weird. But I never really thought that would be something I'd study professionally. I did a continent in African American studies at Michigan State. And then when I met you at Columbia, I was initially planning on doing something on the historiography of slavery for a PhD dissertation. But I took a research seminar with Alan Brinkley, who became my advisor. And it became clear sort of in the mid 90s when I was starting graduate school that the first generation of historians who were too young to have sort of experienced the 60s politically in any meaningful way were beginning to write about it. So there was a cohort of people who were just a few years older than me, really, who I thought were kind of trailblazers as young historians of the new left and the counterculture. And that really excited me. So I just did a paper in the seminar for Alan Brinkley, and I liked the direction that was going. And it seemed to me there was a lot of primary source material that hadn't really been examined or scrutinized yet by professional historians. And so I made the switch right around then and haven't really looked back too much. Nowadays, I'm trying to branch into the 1970s a bit, but I've been identified with the 60s for a long time.
I think particularly doing kind of the history of the new left is sort of a tricky thing because so many people who were participants ended up in academia and were kind of, it's very much a generation that sort of sought to write its own history and sought to do analysis of its own movements. Is that, I mean, I think, as you said, there's sort of an advantage to being that next generation that doesn't have personal memory or that kind of skin in the game. But is that also a challenge? Because, it's not like, I mean, I'm a 19th century historian, so everybody's dead. So nobody can get mad at me.
Right.
But is that a challenge when you're, working not just with, more recent history, but with recent history where so many of the participants are there in the academy?
Right. Yeah. Well, I mean, you're correct that, obviously an uncanny number of people who played big roles in the leadership of the new left went on to become professors, whether in sociology or history or whatever else. And people like James Miller and Todd Gitlin and Michael Kazin, Maurice Isserman, and others, are all big influential scholars in the field. And I think when I was early on in my career, I had a little bit of a chip on my shoulder and this sense that maybe these, participant observers of the new left were relying too heavily on their own idiosyncratic memories and that maybe they saw themselves as professional gatekeepers or they were resistant to newer interpretations. And then that hasn't really been my experience now that I've had some more time to think about it. So I can't say I've had a lot of, I can't say it's been terribly difficult, writing about a topic that many people remember firsthand, at least from a scholarly perspective. Oftentimes, I'll meet older people and then I will hear from people who are you know, 60s veterans who tell me that, you know, that's just not the way it was, and they seem to be relying pretty heavily on their own, you know, experience and not really looking at the breadth of evidence that I've studied. But I'm down for it. It hasn't been too hard.
Well, that's encouraging. In what ways did your previous projects working on the New Left, and particularly on sort of the rise of alternative media, lead you to this project, to looking seriously, particularly right. at the media presentation of the Beatles and the Stones? I mean, this, I think it's fair to say that maybe not, you know, the most essential piece, but a really central piece of this book's heft is about kind of the way these bands interact with media, the way media portrays these bands. Is mm-hmm. you know, was that a kind of site of linkage that led to this? How did you end up doing a book on?
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, so as you mentioned, my first book that was based on my dissertation was Smoking Typewriters, and that was on the underground newspapers in the late 1960s. And when I was researching that book, I came across a lot of really interesting material that I couldn't include. It was dealing with the debate over which band had the better, whether the Beatles or the Rolling Stones had the correct political analysis in the late 60s. And I write about this in the book. The Beatles were seen as kind of a, you know, more aligned with the flower power and the hippies, and the Stones were more aligned with New Left militants. And this debate was carried on in a very intense way in these underground newspapers by these young amateur journalists. And it was really striking to me how passionate a lot of young people were about this debate, whether the Beatles or the Stones had the right analysis. But none of that really fit within my Smoking Typewriters. So I ended up using that material in an essay, a standalone essay, that later morphed into the book. So there's a pretty direct connection between my research from Smoking Typewriters and the Beatles and the Stones. And yes, I'm interested. And then people often used to say, you know, there's not a lot new. There's nothing more to uncover about the Beatles and the Stones, especially the Beatles. Their record has been poured over, and the primary sources have been examined. And then I found that wasn't exactly true. No other scholar had brought to life these underground press accounts that I use in Chapter 5. So I thought that was kind of neat to bring this source material to light for readers.
And that, I think, is also a really interesting observation and an interesting historical moment when you have these very earnest, but usually very young and very political kind of writers and activists who are nevertheless looking at what in the previous generation, you know, was seen as kind of apolitical, you know, sort of pop culture fluff, the stuff of popular music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the shift where that is taken so seriously that, you know, these newspapers, these writers and editors could be debating with total earnestness about,
sure.
you know, the political outlook of a band that hasn't actually expressed a political outlook in most cases.
Yeah.
You know, there's a kind of interesting, you know, on the one hand, that's an interesting sort of Rorschach, you know, media Rorschach, where they're kind of reading things into this popular, you know, this popular cultural products, but also the ways in which things that had been seen as fluffy, you know, were now taken so seriously that this is part of, you know, a serious political discourse. You have to get right, not just with, you know, your views on sort of socialism, the use of force and, you know, racial hierarchy, but also, you know, whether it's going to be, you know, the Beatles or the Stones.
Yeah. You know, well, at the same time, I guess that these, you know, a lot of pop and rock artists from the 1960s became more, you know, artistically ambitious. You had the, you know, the youth culture movement was really going. And then people seem to glom onto these groups and they would take the music so incredibly seriously, to the extent that they were looking for, you know, hidden meanings or, you know, and doing very close, very careful, you know, textual analysis of the lyrics and so on, and really trying to scrutinize these bands to figure out what they were thinking and, you know, what was the right direction to move ahead. You know, what message were they trying to give to young people in that day? And in hindsight, it seems a little bit silly and a little bit overwrought, especially with, as you said, you know, neither of these bands were terribly political. You know, the Beatles did identify somewhat with the sort of flower power and so on, and then the Stones engaged in just a, you know, maybe a little bit of revolutionary or militant posturing, but none of them really, you know, embraced a coherent political cosmology. They really didn't have a lot to say about, you know, what they thought young people should be doing in that particular moment.
Yeah, I think this book straddles a really interesting challenge, because on the one hand, you want to, you know, you're depicting this sort of inherited history of these bands, you know, that there was a rivalry that was played out in the press that, as you said, you know, the Beatles aligned with certain political views, the Stones with others. If you were a Beatles person, that said certain things about you. But at the same time, you're also trying to get below that kind of media understanding to a little bit more about how the bands functioned as producers of art and as, you know, producers of commerce. And kind of how in the crafting of this book, how do you kind of balance those two narratives, right? The sort of true but far less known narrative on the one hand, and then on the other hand, this narrative that's very familiar but also very hard to write about. I mean, as you said, you know, the Beatles are a phenomenon so big and so remarked upon even at their own time that it's got to be hard as a historian to kind of do history in a serious, careful way about something like that. There's so much material about the Beatles.
Right.
But at the same time, ultimately, you know, they had, what, 5 or 6 productive years, 6 or 7 years? You know, not much produced by the Beatles.
Well, like they were remarkably productive during the time that they
during
were
the time,
a band. But there was this period, you know, where they were the Beatles and they weren't recording anything. So we don't know enough about the early days. But, you know, from 62 to 1970, from the time of their first record until the time they broke up, they were working incredibly hard, putting out a great deal of material, I would say.
Right.
But that's what you're driving at.
Well, even the most productive pop band is only giving you sort of 2 sides of an LP once or twice a year, you know, like the total number of words that they disseminate.
Probably only a couple hours. If you start to finish, you could probably play the whole Beatles catalog in a few hours, I guess.
Exactly. But as compared to the amount of stuff that was, you know, positively or negatively being, you know, dumped on the culture about what the Beatles mean and who they are. And, you know, on the one hand, you've got an enormous amount of stuff as a historian to shovel through. And on the other hand, not that much by the actual producers, you know, to get down to, you know, the kind of truth of their story. And I want to kind of go back and talk a little bit about.
From a writing perspective, you're absolutely right. I mean, it would take almost, you could listen to the Beatles catalog in a few hours, but it would take almost a lifetime to read everything that's been written about the Beatles. But what I found really interesting and edifying and useful was to go back to the primary sources. So even though this is a book that was meant to be maybe for a more of a general audience than a scholarly one, I used a lot of the same training that we picked up at Columbia. And so I would go to not just underground newspapers, but also fan magazines about the groups and, you know, some of the trade music papers from England in the day. And use those for source material, and I've found a lot of neat stuff that just wasn't appearing in the big biographies, and I think I was able to bring some of this new material to life, and that helped me also. Like going to the primary sources really helped me sort of weed out a lot of things, and I found myself, you know, assembling a familiar narrative but using sources that were a little far flung, and that seemed to benefit the book in my view.
That was one of the things that I thought was really striking is there's so many moments where the received narrative doesn't match very well, or is even almost the opposite, right? You know, the four kind of good lads from Liverpool, you know, are, you know, come up pretty rough in their teen years.
Yeah.
You know, Paul McCartney is portrayed, you know, is sort of understood to be this, you know, very sweet guy, but he's you know, at least in some of the stories you have, kind of a dirtbag as a kid. You know, and by the other hand, you know, by on the other side, you've got the Stones, who have this kind of, you know, rebellious London swagger. But they're mostly pretty well educated, good upper middle class lads who, you know, if it wasn't this, it would have been, you know, being politicians or solicitors or, you know.
Yeah. I mean, there were class differences within both bands, but you're right, you know, with the Stones and Mick Jagger, I think a lot of people know he went to the London School of Economics, which is a prestigious school. And this is a time when, you know, very few, just a, you know, small percentage of, you know, British kids went on to university, to get university educations. And then Brian Jones was an outstanding student for all of his psychological problems, which became apparent later. You know, he also, you know, did very well in his exams and could have, you know, had an elite career in politics, business, if that's what he wanted to do. But they got into the blues, and I think they really embraced that blues aesthetic. And I don't think that their, you know, their image as sort of ne'er-do-well the Bohemians was entirely a put on. I think that they, you know, and I think that they engaged in, you know, I think they really immersed themselves in this, you know, blues aesthetic and this lifestyle, because that's what they thought was suitable for them in many respects.
That sort of brings up another interesting tension in the book, and really anything that writes about popular music and popular culture has to deal with the sort of 900-pound gorilla of authenticity. And, you know, this stuff, you know, they're producing in a time before people were as savvy or cynical about the problematics of appropriation and
right.
sort of just how problematic a term authenticity can be. And a lot of the reception of the bands had to do with, you know, the Beatles as a kind of national treasure, you know, as sort of, good young lads, especially in the early phase of their career, you know, as opposed to the Stones. You know, initially they're very, Jones in particular seems very interested in authenticity and kind of bringing the Chicago electric blues, you know, Muddy Waters and John Lee Hooker, and just sort of translating it to a young, you know, English, British audience and setting. You know, how as a historian, knowing how problematic that kind of stuff is, how do you deal with questions of you know, these folks' attempts at authenticity, especially because, I know this is a question with too many clauses, but especially because there was such a big media machine around both bands ultimately, you know, to market them and to package them as one thing or another. So you have the band trying to produce something, you have something trying to be built around the band to sell this image that they're producing. You know, how do you sift through all of that? And, you know, I would say, you know, you do a very good job of kind of making sense of all of that. But, you know, looking at the primary material, that's got to be a really sort of terrifying quest.
Well, you know, I think you're absolutely right. People are less savvy on this question of authenticity and also the ways in which bands were marketed. I don't think people realized how much artifice sort of went into that sort of thing back then. But I give both the Beatles and the Stones a lot of credit, and especially the Stones, for always, you know, acknowledging the debt that they owed to these, you know, pioneers. The Beatles are very influenced by Motown and girl groups, especially, and they made that very clear. And then the Stones were almost, you know, evangelical about, you know, admitting that they, you know, they had grown up on those, you know, famous pioneering blues artists that you mentioned, and they never felt that they were any better than those groups. I think, in fact, they probably seemed to feel a little bit guilty. They had such reverence for people like Bo Diddley or Muddy Waters or Howlin' Wolf. And I think they realized that, you know, it was ironic and maybe unfair that, you know, they were these white people who were interpreting their music. And then, again, as you said, selling it back to, you know, British and American teens, and all of, you know, anyone who wanted to could have gone right to the source if they had so desired. And I guess it never occurred to a lot of young audiences to do that. But the Beatles and the Stones never discouraged anyone. I always acknowledged where their influences came from.
That's another thing that I think is really interesting about sort of the whole British invasion era, is it's so central in American popular culture, right? Both bands, as you just said, are drawing on American musical influences, American cultural touchstones that, you know, they sort of consumed as kids in the UK, in post-war Britain. But then, right, you know, this sort of, you know, as you point out in the book, the kind of military language of invasion gets invoked as kind of a reinterpreted version of American, you know, American artistic production. American music is brought back and then consumed en masse by an American audience, and then debated by a kind of, you know, all these folks in your, you know, in the smoking typewriters kinds of alternative media. You know, to what extent were they aware of that kind of, circle that the Beatles become a major, you know, the Beatles and the Stones are major pieces of American pop culture, you know, whose origins are in the UK, playing music and stuff, whose origins are, you know, that sort of feedback loop of culture. To what extent are they aware of that? To what extent are they playing with that? You know, are they anxious
about that? I'm not sure. Yeah, I'm not sure if I fully understand what you're driving at. But, in order to get your hands on the kind of music that the Beatles and the Stones liked as teenagers and as young men, I mean, you had to work hard to find the kind of American music in England that the Beatles were most interested in. You had to sort of search it out in music catalogs and special order and everything else. And so they grew up with, you know, incredible reverence and admiration for a lot of American artists, and then they were so excited by the United States. You know, none of them had been here until they came over as musicians, and they were just in awe with New York City and Los Angeles and everything else. And I think that was when they started to feel they had really sort of made it. To make it in England was one thing, but the United States was always the big prize, and so they were always in many ways, you know, oriented towards the U.S. and you know, really wanting to have success. I know that for sure.
But they also, you know, it was readily clear to them very quickly, you know, after the, you know, they land at the airport and head to Shea Stadium. It was abundantly clear to everyone, you know, whether within the Beatles or within American culture, that this was a major event.
Yeah.
You know, like the sort of the screaming, the crying, the, you know, you know, it's,
I mean,
it's
the
like,
Beatles themselves could, the Beatles themselves could never really understand it. They were people would ask them all the time, you know, what's causing Beatlemania? What is this really about? None of them were actually, you know, very sure themselves. But they knew it was a major event, but they also thought it was going to be a fad. They thought, I was talking before about how productive they seemed, and especially in the early 60s. And then they were working their tails off because they had the sense that, you know, Beatlemania was going to, it was just going to be a couple of years and that would be it. And then there was no precedent for this, you know, pop artists or teen idols growing and maturing and having the kind of longevity that the Beatles and the Stones, you know, ended up having. Sorry, I guess I cut you off. Sorry.
No. That's actually kind of right where I wanted to go is, you know, I think especially for the Beatles, it's almost like they knew there was a clock on it. They thought the clock would be imposed by the culture. It ended up, I think, ultimately imposed by their own kind of moving in different artistic directions. I think the Stones, it seems like, thought some of the music they were playing was more timeless, at least in origin.
Mm-hmm.
They too sort of said, like, you know, I don't want to be up there stomping around singing Satisfaction when I'm an old man, you know, and yet, you know, coming to an arena near you probably in the next few weeks somewhere.
They were just in Atlanta a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
So I'm sure for the last time, but literally, I think it was in June or July they were here.
You know, that sort of neither band, I think, could understand the way that generation's pop idols would be allowed to kind of age and mature artistically and then just, you know, mature geriatrically. But is there a way in which, I think, particularly thinking of the Beatles, you know, as a historian, you know, how do you try to explain Beatlemania and kind of what, you know, is this a sort of right place, right time, you know, if, you know, four reasonably talented young men with quirky haircuts could have been anyone at that point. Or, you know, was the culture sort of set up for that kind of change, or are these bands really moving sort of the artistic production, pushing into the culture, whether intentionally or, you know, in some cases, I think kind of reluctantly.
There are lots of other, you know, bands from that era that didn't have the power of the Beatles. So I think we have to give them a lot of credit for just being, you know, very incredible musicians and songwriters and everything else. But their timing was, in fact, impeccable. I mean, there was, you know, the baby boom was just getting underway in the United States, and the economy was booming. And so this huge teen market was emerging just at the same time that the Beatles were hitting their creative stride. And so I think that mattered enormously. And there are certain, like, distinctive features that a lot of other bands didn't have. The fact that they were a coherent group, they were the Beatles, as opposed to a lot of other pop groups, which would have, you know, someone else sent, you know, Bill Haley or someone else with a flashy stage name and then a backing group behind them, was sort of customary. The Beatles were you know, a group, and they saw themselves as this, you know, communal gang of artists. And I think people saw them that way. And yet they all had these distinctive personalities that young fans could relate to. And then, unlike a lot of other groups from their era, they were very, as I mentioned before, steeped in the cliches of these Motown girl groups. And so they would, you know, project a kind of tenderness and a vulnerability in their songs that really seemed to speak to very young teenage girls. And I think we forget sometimes how, you know, young the audience was, how young the Beatles' core audience was when Beatlemania was first getting going. It was, you know, teens and preteens, you know. But they seem to have some way of sort of addressing them directly that seem to transfix a lot of these very young girls. And those are some of the qualities I think they had that made them, you know, really novel for their time. And I don't think, looking back, people realize just how unusual and how distinctive, you know, they were.
And I mean, so what makes them, to push that a little further, what makes them different other than the fact that it's a group, that it's a quartet? Than some of the kind of prefab sort of teen idols, you know, the Fabians and the ones with the perfectly coiffed, you know, the perfectly coiffed hair that sang songs that got spit out of the Brill Building.
Right.
That are what, you know, God, my mother, you know, and her Pat Boone records. But, you know, that's sort of trying, you know, that's certainly trying to capture that same market and doing it, you know, they fought relatively well until you saw, you know, how well the Beatles could capture that market.
I don't know if they were more musically innovative, or maybe they were just doing, I think they were just a little more quirky and novel than some of those, you know, prefabricated, you know, artists that you're mentioning. And they seemed unusual enough to American audiences. And that gave them maybe a special allure, but it, you know, it's hard to say exactly what accounts for Beatlemania. And it's interesting that, you know, we may never know exactly. There was really a mass pandemic, and there's really nothing, there's not been anything like Beatlemania before or since. And yet I'm not sure anyone has come across, has been able to sort of articulate a very precise explanation for what caused Beatlemania. There are a few more things related to the timing that some people have speculated. You know, for instance, I guess the Beatles came to the U.S. in February of 1964, and John F. Kennedy had been assassinated in November of 63. So some people have argued that, you know, Americans had gone through a sort of a grieving stage, and even these young teenagers would not have understood, you know, in all of its dimensions, what Kennedy's assassination meant, but they would have internalized that something terrible had happened. And then after, you know, a couple months of this, they were ready for something happy and exuberant and exciting. because other Beatles timing may have, you know, worked to their advantage in that respect. Although there was a wave of Beatlemania in England as well before John Kennedy was assassinated, and Kennedy's assassination would not have meant very much to teenagers in England. Mm-hmm. So it was really hard to say. I think it's a great question.
In looking at the Stones, right, they have to do everything kind of in the wake of the Beatles.
Yeah.
Right. You know, I mean, initially they think it's going to be fine because they're a London band and, you know, how deep can the bench in Liverpool be? And then all of a sudden, yeah. No, every band has to have, you know, a Scouse accent and, you know, and so much of, I think the way you depict the Stones' early career is sort of vacillating between emulating the Beatles in a lot of different yeah. ways. You know, I mean, you look at some of the early publicity shots and it's not hard to see who they're trying to look like, at least a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But even kind of professionally, when they make the move from interpreting American blues songs to writing their own work, right? I mean, that's, you have sort of a great story in the book about, you know, that is explicitly in some ways a product of interaction with Lennon and McCartney, right? They sort of watch yeah. Lennon and McCartney write a song and they're like, wow, you know, these mm-hmm. guys are good. We should try to be sort of like that. But at the same yeah. time, they also have to be constantly, you know, following in the Stone or in the Beatles' wake, but also trying to define themselves as something other than the Beatles.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there are, I don't know if it's super well known, but very, very early on when the Stones were first getting going, their manager tried to, you know, style them similar to the Beatles. He had them in matching suits and outfits, and their hair was trimmed a bit, and they had them smiling in their photo shoots. And there's only a couple photo shoots like this. And then I guess the story goes that the Stones became, you know, just naturally they were a little more slovenly and a little more laid back and relaxed in the performance style. So then their manager, Andrew Oldham, had the idea to consciously, you know, style them as sort of the anti-Beatles. So they would not use the Beatles in the forts, and they would not be, you know, quite as scripted as the Beatles were in their public appearances. And they would be a little more, you know, edgy or rebellious or impolite than they probably actually wanted to be. But then this new image seemed to suit them. And so they very quickly sort of caught on as the anti-Beatles, at least in England initially. But at the same time, they never stopped. They were always preoccupied with how the Beatles were doing. And, you know, when people talk about this rivalry, they can talk about it in terms of you know, aesthetic credibility or whatever else. But in terms of record sales, the Beatles always outsold the Stones by a huge amount. And I think that rankled the Stones a little bit. You know, they always measured themselves, you know, in regard to the Beatles.
Mm-hmm. There's no catching, you know, the most sort of seminal pop group of the pop era. And so that's got to be yeah. a kind of frustrating benchmark.
Yeah.
From the beginning.
But they were, you know, it's a complicated dynamic because, you know, you mentioned the Liverpool, London thing, and I don't know if American audiences are as aware of this, but, you know, back then and to some degree today, you know, people who lived in London would sort of look down on Northern England, kind of the way perhaps, you know, someone in Cambridge or New York City might look down on someone from the South. I mean, these are stereotypes, but there was this sense that Northern England was sort of, you know, behind the times creatively and culturally from London, and yet the Beatles came from Liverpool, and then the Stones were sort of perplexed, I think, by that initially, and yet at the same time the Beatles were so, I'm getting another call, I'm just gonna ignore it. You know, the Beatles had such commercial success, and they're really the leading lights of the pop scene, and I think the Stones, you know, found them for a little bit in awe of the Beatles, and at the same time they had maybe looked down on them a little bit, had been perplexed by them at first. They also were in awe of them and enjoyed being seen in their company and measured their accomplishments against what the Beatles were doing. And that, you know, that fueled a rivalry that was, you know, for the most part friendly, but it also at times, you know, it was on the minds of, I think, the Rolling Stones a lot.
A minute ago, you mentioned the Stones kind of handler, their manager. And one of the things I think is really great about this book is it brings it brings into the story a lot of the, you know, the sort of media soothsayers and managers and the kind of record business and promotion side of it. Can you talk a little bit about some of those key figures that aren't, you know, band members, but are nevertheless really sort of central to the story of these two bands?
Sure. You know, well, I think it's pretty well known that the Beatles were managed by Brian Epstein, and he was the guy who persuaded them very early on to tidy up their image. And so in the earliest incarnation, the Beatles specialized in, you know, playing American rock and roll. And when they were in Germany, they would, you know, sometimes style themselves in leather outfits, and they were known for, you know, drinking on stage and everything else. And they were more of a raucous act than they became. And it was the Beatles manager who persuaded them to, you know, eventually wear suits and bow after their songs, and he choreographed even their stage banter and everything else. And that was, you know, he did that right around the time the Beatles were beginning to have, well, he did this right before the Beatles had their big breakthrough. So I think he deserves a lot of credit in that regard. And Andrew Oldham was the guy who managed the Stones in their early days. And I guess I already described how he had the bright idea of portraying the Stones as the anti-Beatles, and that image seemed to suit them really well. And of course, for the tabloids, this was great fodder. This was a great thing. The Beatles and the Stones became seen as rivals, you know, in the very early 60s. And even when the Beatles were outselling the Stones, you know, if there was a fan poll or a reader poll where the Stones came out on top, that would be, you know, big front page news, and journalists were always asking about this supposed Beatles and Stones rivalry. And the bands would try to downplay this, but nevertheless, the ways that Two Goose were marketed worked to their advantage, at least for a while in the early 60s. Mm-hmm. I think by the mid to late 60s, certainly the Beatles found this really silly. They really wanted to leave those teen idol reputations behind, as they did.
So, I mean, would it be fair to say that the Beatles wanted to stop being asked about the Stones before the Stones wanted to stop being measured against the Beatles?
Oh, geez, that's hard to say. I think even though, I mean, in fact, they were, for the most part, friendly with each other. I mean, they sincerely admired each other and they enjoyed each other's company, but I don't think that stopped them from, you know, always being cognizant of how the other group is doing and what they were up to. And I don't think the group stopped measuring themselves against each other. And so, I'm sure they had other things to think about as well. So constantly being asked about each other, they may have gotten on their nerves at some point.
And it seems like both bands at a certain point, kind of outgrew the initial kind of media world that, you know, and marketing world that they were, that they came out of.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You know, sort of
sending
away the official reporter for the fan magazine. And I think the Beatles end up like shuttering the kind of, you know, the Beatles, you know, fan club magazine. You know, because they seem to be, you know, pretty quickly, both bands feel sort of stifled by that teen image when they wanted to kind of develop as artists and as, you know.
It was always the hardest for John Lennon and the Beatles. I mean, because he was originally, you know, he went to art school. He was the most bohemian of them all, you know, and he saw himself as sort of an iconoclast. And you know, I think for the Beatles early on, he felt like he had to make, you know, certain compromises in order for the group to be successful. And he was very willing to do that for a point. But after they had such great success, you know, I think, you know, being trapped in this image where he couldn't talk about what he couldn't speak, he didn't say what was on his mind, and he was always on guard because he might cause some sort of controversy. And, you know, he was so conscripted into the suits and everything else. That was tough for him. So he was more anxious to leave that behind, and as they eventually did.
And I think one of the stories that was particularly interesting to me in reading Beatles versus Stones was kind of the way you portray Brian Jones, you know, who sort of, at least initially, has sort of the reverse trajectory, right? That he starts as this kind of iconoclast, you know, I'm going to be true to the blues because that's all that matters, and then sort of sees – the Beatles' success and sees a taste of their success and, you know, is very quickly the one that says, yes, that's, you know, that's what I want. Uh-huh. I want the adulation, uh-huh. I want the groupies, I want the trappings of rock and roll mm-hmm. stardom, you know, never mind this blues, fealty to the truth of the original art form. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, Jones comes off in this book a really sort of a difficult character. He's sort of petulant. He's outshined sure. by, you know, Jagger and Richards in his own band. He's narcissistic. There's a lot of talk about, you know, his hair. There's a lot of him talking about his hair, what I find really interesting about that portrayal of Jones, which is not, I think, kind of the popular understanding of him, is it's so starkly different than the way he in particular was kind of received. And I'm thinking here of some of the stuff in Patti Smith's memoir, Just Kids, where she talks about, you know, almost everyone she bumps into in this kind of bohemian late 60s New York City art world identifies with, you know, is heartbroken by the death of Brian Jones, but they see him as this very kind of sweet, artistic soul.
Yeah.
And I find that, that disconnect really fascinating, right? That
yeah.
there's such a, you know, so many people, whether it's, you know, artists in the New Left or whether it's teeny boppers or kind of the media fanning the flames of teeny bopperdom, they're all so far removed from these actual people, these actual artists, that, you know, they're really in some cases dramatically different narratives or trajectories that are, you know, carrying along
right.
this book. You know, there's what the Stones yeah. are like and what the Beatles are like, and then what everyone thinks they're like. And there's several,
sure.
you know, there's several groups of everyone and several groups of what they think these bands are like.
Mm-hmm.
But that, you know, I'm really struck particularly with that in Jones, who was seen, you know, being kind of too young, you know, like you, to have experienced either Beatlemania or, you know,
yeah.
Stones, you know, the,
yeah.
there's
yeah.
no good word like, maybe that was their, you know, that's why they never matched the Beatles, is there's no good, you know, Stones mania term that's quite as catchy. That may have been what they,
yeah.
But, you know, it's, yeah. it's hard for me to kind of understand that very earnest, adoration of any of these people, the way that it's depicted in, you know, in your book and in Patti Smith's book, the way that people kind of consume these artists as very serious artists and thinkers
yeah.
and stuff, you know.
I mean, I think part of it has to do with the fact that, you know, rock and roll is still, you know, it was newer back then, and it was very much understood as like youth music. You know, nowadays, you know, there's so many different types of music, and then there's so many different genres, and people relate to it at different levels at all ages. You know, but back then it was seen as, you know, truly, you know, kind of, the Rolling Stones were seen as and the Beatles in the late 60s as, you know, countercultural, having a, you know, a special identification and message for young people. And I think people responded to that. And Brian Jones was a tough figure because, you know, he probably did have, you know, a sweet side to his personality. And as a historian, we're not supposed to, I guess, make a psychological diagnosis. I'm not really trained to do that. But he must have had some kind of, you know, serious personality disorder, because he could be also so incredibly, you know, cruel and dishonest and almost, you know, psychopathic in some respects.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he had you know, such a tough life at the end. It's hard not to feel a little bit sorry for him, that the way he gets, you know, marginalized from his own band. And, you know, as bad as he was, I don't get the impression that Mick or Keith were terribly kind to Brian Jones either. You know, I think they kind of preyed upon his weakness and so that story is I think ultimately kind of a sad story where no one comes out looking too good. But he looked, you know, until he was ravaged by drugs, he was, you know, a very handsome guy and he was charismatic and he had a great sense of fashion and style and everything else. And I think that's part of what, you know, people like Patti Smith were responding to. Part of it was just that, you know, their sexuality and their charm and their charisma is projected through their music. That's something that a lot of people were responding to, I think.
Mm-hmm. Do you think this also speaks to that, you know, kind of as a historian of the 60s, that kind of ability to connect to these artists as sort of spokesmen of a generation and for a certain changing outlook in the world, like, is that just less possible in other generations? And it's, again, I get sort of back to the question of timing, but, you know, it's hard, at least for me, to conceive of what, you know, what a Beatles or a Stones would look like coming out now, or what an analog would have been, even, you know, in the kind of 80s and 90s when I was growing up, for a band to be kind of as popular as either of these bands, but also taken so seriously artistically and politically, seems almost impossible, right? You know, nobody was asking about how, you know, the New Kids on the Block felt about the invasion of Grenada. although, like, now I really want to find that interview because that would just
I was going to say.
There's an article in that for sure.
Well, it's a little funny thing when sometimes I hear people compare, you know, certain boy bands, whatever boy band is popular at a particular moment, Justin Bieber or One Direction or whatever, they'll get compared to the Beatles, and those people don't have a really good, you know, frame of reference. You know, I'm just speculating here, but, you know, I guess what I was trying to suggest earlier is just that the audience for rock and roll is, since it's so segmented nowadays, and I don't think we're going to have one band that's going to speak to young people the way the Beatles and the Stones did. You know, young people, you know, it is a big group. I think in certain subcultures, probably people, you know, glom onto bands that matter, you know, a great deal to them, whether maybe in punk rock or indie rock or whatever else, and they experience artists with, you know, an incredible amount of, you know, intensity, and that's one of the great things about rock and roll is that people, you know, have those relationships with the artists they care about. But I just don't see a group having the kind of broad impact of the Beatles again. I don't see how it could happen in this current era.
Just the amount of cultural diffusion and the number of platforms make it impossible for anybody to reach so many people.
Yeah, that's a better way. Thank you. Yeah. I think that's a better way of saying it, sure.
You know, I want to go back to some of these other people and the sort of the business side of these bands for a minute. You talked about kind of the early days and sort of Alden and Epstein. And of course, lots of people have written or talked about kind of the importance of George Martin, particularly on kind of the sound of the Beatles in the sort of early to mid years. But I'm interested also in kind of what you do with, particularly in chapter 6, Wheel Dealing in the Pop Jungle, where you talk about kind of the Beatles' attempt at kind of controlling their own, the business side of things and creating Apple Records and the Stones' kind of relationship with the sort of dubious impresario, Alan Klein. Mm-hmm. What can you say about sort of that side of the story? Because that, I think, is one that people largely, don't know until they engage with your book.
It's sad to me to think that, you know, part of the impetus for the Beatles' breakup was a feud about money, you know, and I think I know, of course, there were other things at work, you know, so you can't just isolate one thing to explain a phenomenon as complicated as, you know, why the Beatles broke up. You know, but a lot of it had to do with the group was divided over whether or not they wanted Alan Klein to be their manager. And, you know, he had a reputation as a sort of shark-eyed money man who had, you know, made a big impact in the music business, getting really good deals for his clients. But he was also pretty widely known to be, you know, ethically challenged or unscrupulous or whatever else. So he took the, he had managed the Stones for a brief period, or no, for a long period. It took a long time for the Stones to extricate themselves from him. But, you know, he really ripped them off. He controlled the copyright for a lot of their songs. And he got the Stones to sort of sign over their rights to these songs without really knowing exactly what they were doing. And then he set his sights on the Beatles. And that caused a huge division in the group. John persuaded George and Ringo to want to go with Alan Klein, and Paul did not want to go with him. He wanted to go with his wife's father as their manager, and that was unacceptable to the other three. and that was one of the things they just couldn't reconcile. I always thought that was kind of sad. I mean, that always sort of bothered me a little bit. The petty squabbling about money was part of the reason for their downfall.
Yeah, I mean, the kind of the conventional and I would argue fairly sexist argument that it was Yoko that broke up the Beatles is wrong. It was actually Alan Klein.
I played a very negative role too, though. I don't know if it's sexist or not. I mean, she endured a lot of sexism for sure. Mm-hmm. But I also think she had a pretty pernicious influence on the group dynamic. So.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, it's interesting because I think, you know, she came out of this kind of, you know, Japanese avant-garde art world, which was something that I think, you know, it seems like John was very drawn to, mm-hmm. in a way that the rest of the Beatles were like, you know, boy, do we not care about this nonsense.
yeah.
And, you know, I'm not taking a side on either side there. 'Cause, you know, happily it's not my period, so I don't have to. I am really struck by how much of this, as you said, you know, very sadly in the case of the Beatles, how much of this is a money story ultimately, that this is, you know, this is not only a story of, you know, counterculture politics read through these bands, which is kind of, as you said, how you got to the project, right? That, you know, mm-hmm. you're reading these battles over which is, you know, which is the better band or which is the more politically important band in independent press of the late 60s. But it's also very much a story of kind of mid to late 20th century mass capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in some ways, you know, if you want to find a way that the Stones win, right? You know, I remember seeing in high school or in college, an article in, I think, the Wall Street Journal or some similar publication about kind of the brilliant business machine that was the Stones touring show.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking like, you know, oh, maybe they, you know, in reflecting back on both this book and that article from long ago, I'm like, oh, maybe they did win, you know, in a certain way. But as you know, and that shift that happened, right? I mean, by the 80s and 90s, Jerry Garcia was selling $100 ties.
Yeah.
You know, the sort of commercialization was simultaneously both always there and also, mm-hmm. you know, rejected or resisted or ambivalently embraced, maybe mm-hmm. by the artists themselves, but certainly, you know, the Kleins, the Epsteins, the Martins, Ray Coleman at Melody Maker, right? These are all people who are not confused about the fact that both of these bands are businesses.
That's right. Yeah, no, that's a good way of putting it. Yeah. And the Beatles and the groups themselves really concerned about it. I mean, they would sort of time their releases in ways that they thought they could make the most amount of money. They put out a record, you know, right before Christmas. And you know, I think I quote in the book Paul McCartney talking about how, you know, the idea that the Beatles were some kind of anti-bourgeois band or anti-capitalist force, it was just a terrible myth. They were, as we mentioned before, really intent on making as much money as they possibly could while the iron was hot, and that accounted for a lot of their productivity. And there's some very funny quotes in the book from John Lennon at press conferences talking about how great it was to be making all this money. People would want to ask him all sorts of things, and he's like, "We're just in it for the money, you know." and what lessons are you leaving for American kids? And it's how to make money quick. And what are you going to do with your money? He's like, "We're going to spend it." And he was just really excited about all that stuff.
And that's one of the sort of great things about, you know, the Beatles' ability to kind of, you know, tell a really crass truth like that, and then, you know, sort of the media and their audience is like, oh, that Joker, you know, oh, John yeah. Paul, they're so funny. And they're like, no, oh, we're yeah, actually, it's just where do we pick up the check, you know?
Yeah, sure. You know, I saw the Rolling Stones in only once in, I think, the mid-90s. I was a master's degree at Michigan State at the time, and they played at the stadium, and it was $100, which in 1994 just seemed like an astronomical amount to spend for a ticket. And I was so angry, but you know, that the stadium was just about a mile and a half away from where I live, so I couldn't really not go, you know. So, you know, we went to the show, but just $100 back then seemed like an outrageous amount to spend for a rock show.
Now $100 wouldn't get you a nosebleed to a Stones show.
Sure. I understand the value of the dollar has changed, but it's still, and I've always found the way the Stones have, you know, marketed themselves in recent years a little bit tacky. I think we're about the same age. It might be just a little bit older than you, but you know, back when we were in high school, when they had the Steel Wheels tour, and there was, you know, you could everything you could put a Rolling Stones logo on had a Rolling Stones, you know, logo, boxer shorts and keychains and everything else, trading cards, all that stuff.
Yeah, they were sort of at the vanguard of that kind of just, we will sell anything.
I should have begrudged them that, but I thought it was kind of tacky even then, and so now, especially, I tend to feel that way.
And that's something that I think is really interesting about the epilogue of the book, where, of course, one of these bands ends up pressed in amber in, you know, I think it's April 1970. Right. Yeah. And then, you know, with the passing first of John Lennon, it becomes kind of, you know, the will there ever be a reunion tour, you know, becomes impossible. But, you know, the Stones just keep chugging along. And as a historian, does that kind of change how the band is seen? So the fact that you can still go see some version of the Stones. You know, you can still see Mick, you know, sort of strutting around on stage. Does that change the meaning retroactively of what they were doing in 1964, 5, 6 in a way that the Beatles can't?
I think it shapes the debate about the Dukes, you know, to the extent that, you know, the Beatles were still very much sort of, you know, near their prime when they disbanded, and then they never recorded it together again. They never shared a stage again. They just sort of split up. Whereas, you know, the Stones had a great period in the early 70s where they were really at the top of their game. But, you know, but the fact that they kept going into the 80s and 90s and, you know, as recently as today, you know, putting out, you know, sort of lackluster records without very many good songs, but then they tour, and their tours were sort of golden oldies packages. They wouldn't really push any new material. They just played the same songs from the 60s and 70s, and they didn't even really play around much with their own arrangements. They would play their own songs almost exactly as they sounded on the record, you know, without ever pushing any new material. And in that respect, I think they kind of diluted their catalog. And they may be a little bit less important as a result. I've never really been a big fan of nostalgia acts. I would have loved to have seen the Stones in the late 60s or early 70s. But I think maybe that may have shaped their legacy for some people. Other people would have a different view and you know, not begrudge the fact that they put out so much music. And you know, the records have never been bad for the most part, but they certainly haven't, you know, measured up to what they were capable of, you know, when they were at their best.
That leads me to, you know, a short series of closing and highly unfair questions. You know, the first is, do you have a favorite song or album for each band? You know, where do you see the kind of, you know, the height of what they did best?
I would say, I think A Day in the Life is my favorite, you know, Beatles composition. And, you know, I go back and forth between Revolver and Sgt. Pepper is my favorite Beatles album. And then for the Stones, I really like the period with Mick Taylor. So from like 68 to 1974, I love all those records. And so I guess Exile on Main Street might be the Rolling Stones record I go back to an awful lot. The Sticky Fingers, Let It Bleed, I like all those records too. and I have a hard time choosing just one, but it's that genre. It's the Beatles in their, when they're moving into their psychedelic era. So like 65 to 67 and the Stones in like 68 to 74. Those are the periods I like the most.
And, you know, the question that some version of always gets asked at an academic conference, which is, you know, thank you for writing the thing you did. Why didn't you write this other thing that I just thought of? Which is, yeah. You know, where would you put, you know, some other bands, or what would be other bands that you think could be part of this story? I mean, I think the dichotomy you have with the Beatles and Stones,
yeah.
You know, they're clearly the right choice. They're clearly sort of the one and two for, I think, what you've done with them. But, you know, where would the Who go?
Yeah.
In this,
yeah.
Or,
you know, I should preface all this by saying, you know, I'm not a rock critic. And then, you know, as you know, you read the book. I mean, I don't write so much about, you know, aesthetic judgments in the book, because that's just not my strength. I'm not a musician, mm-hmm. either. And so I just don't talk about it as well as I can talk about some of the historical stuff. But I like, you know, I like the Kinks. I think you can make a good case for the Kinks being one of the great acts of the era when they were in their prime. And I love the Who as well. So, you know, there's so much competition between these bands and cross-fertilization, the Beatles and the Stones and the Kinks and the Who, the Beach Boys, you know, and it was such a great time for music. And I think if we focus, you know, over much on the Beatles and the Stones, we can lose track of that fact. But Bob Dylan too, and these bands exerted, you know, quite a bit of influence upon each other. And I think they also, this sort of sense of competition or this fertilization that is going, you know, help to galvanize these bands to try to continue to do their very best work.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, not as, yeah, I don't ask it as like an aesthetic question necessarily. We'll leave that to, you know, rock critics and, you know, musicologists and, you know, people with secret knowledge I don't have, but it does seem to me that, and this comes out in the book in some ways, even though it's really a sort of Beatles and Stones project, that there are these other, you know, pieces of this musical this sort of, you know, musico-cultural landscape that are, you know, that are also echoing some of the same themes and bouncing off each other. And, you know, that there's, you know, these two bands are sort of at the heart of a larger pantheon in a moment of real kind of cultural and musical foment.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess, you know, I want to, you know, thank you for taking the time to talk with me and to do this. You know, I encourage people to run out and buy, you know, a minimum of 9 to 15 copies, I think is probably the right number now that it's in paper.
That's probably not going to happen.
You know, I think that this is, you know, I think it's a terrific read. I think you really get a lot more than kind of the bands. You get a lot of, you can almost do the story of the 60s, you know, with these two bands as an anchor. You know, a lot of the, you know, cultural and political developments are, you know, reflected by what's going on with these bands, or can be read into what's happening with them. Well, but the question, of course, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I appreciate you saying that. I had a lot of fun writing it, and I was enjoying talking with you. So I'm sorry, but I cut you off.
Oh no, I was just going to, you know, the question I have to ask, but I suspect you won't answer, of course, is, you know, Beatles or Stones.
You know what, for you, I'll ask, you know, when this book first came out a couple of years ago, people would always ask, and I was thinking I tried so hard to be, you know, as impartial as I possibly could, because I wanted to write a joint biography of the two groups without, you know, focusing too much about, you know, on, without really delving into which group I thought was better. But everyone would always ask, and I always didn't want to answer. But it's been a few years, so it's the Beatles. I like the Beatles a lot better.
Interesting. Okay, I thought.
Yeah, but I always
that was not my guess, having read it. So.
Oh, good.
So,
well, I always love it when people say that they couldn't tell. I was going for.
Yeah, I didn't have a strong bet either way, but I was suspecting Stones.
Well, people who know me well think it would be the Stones. Maybe it's something about my personality or something like that. But
you know, you rarely wear a tie people. When you speak and then bow at the end. So, you know.
Yeah, but I'm glad. But I truly do love both bands, especially as I said, the Stones in that era. So, but I listen to the Beatles a lot more.
Well, great. So thank you so much for talking to me and for doing this for the New Books Network. Once again, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much, Matt. I really enjoyed talking with you after all this time, and thanks for your interest. It was a lot of fun.